Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, the speaker is Jeanette Rodriguez. She will be speaking on the spirituality of liberation. So, let's listen in on Jeanette Rodriguez.
This morning's session is going to be on liberation theology and spirituality, so I'll give you a second to make sure you're in the right session. And also, I just want to give us a minute. I don't know about you, but I just ran here. So just give us a minute to just sit and sort of prepare ourselves to be open and just to listen to one another. Discipline. There are many perspectives in which theology is done, and some key questions that I think you need to ask yourself when you're talking about theology or spirituality is, under what conditions is the work being done? Right? And a second question is, for whom is the theology being done? And third, to whom is it addressed? So these are really important questions, because the way we do theology in the first world is going to be different than the way we do theology in the third world, and there are reasons for that. So for example, in the first world, theology for the most part is done at the universities. There's an abundant means of materials and productions. People are educated. And the question in North America has been, until recently, you know, how do you combine faith and science? What's the dialogue between church and democracy? How do you justify religion in the face of the critiques of people like Marx and Nietzsche and Freud? And the audience is usually made up of very critical, not criticizing, but critical, thinking, secularized men and women. But theology done in the third world is a little bit different. Theology is done in the midst of extreme poverty, desperate poverty. It's done from a perspective of abundant faith. And so the question, for example, is not, does God exist? Which was a big question in the 20th century, right? The proof of God's existence. Mm-hmm. But rather, how can God exist in the midst of so much suffering, in the midst of so much violence? So the existence of God is never in question. The people doing theology at that level are doing it with people, for the most part, are illiterate. Few theologians work in a nice office at a university that's air-conditioned. people like Gustavo Gutierrez, John Sabrino are very, very poor parishes. And their question is, for them, is how to combine faith with social oppression so that the audience, then, is the oppressed and victims of social injustice. So many, many people forget that, you know, because they get so involved in the political implications of liberation theology, forgetting that what liberation theology really is when faith comes smack, you know, face to face with injustice and violence and poverty, that what is the response? What is the response to that? Leonardo Boff, for example, tells these stories about how he'd be walking outside his cathedral or his church, And there was a very poor woman there, and she had three little children. She had a little baby in her arms, and the baby's crying. Obviously, the baby's very hungry. And Boff says, you know, mujer, he goes, woman, feed your baby. You know, give your baby something to eat. And she goes, you know, father, I can't, you know. And he's really getting annoyed with her. So it was her fault. He's like, feed your baby. And she goes, I can't, father, I can't, you know. And a third time, he goes, please, just feed your baby. So she opens up her blouse, and her breast is bleeding. And the baby starts sucking on the breast, you know. And he was so moved by that, you know, that he sort of fell on his knees and vowed to do something about that. Another story by another priest in South America talks about how the poor people go to confession after Mass or after Eucharist because they go and they receive two or three times just to eat the bread because they're so hungry. You know, I was there a few years ago and I was eating at a restaurant with my aunt and my uncle, and there were these 6, 8, 4-year-old kids outside the restaurant. And we walked in to have some lunch or something, and this little girl, she wasn't about 6 years old, she came to our table, always eyeing the maitre d', you know, because they kind of beat the kids and throw them out at the restaurant to not to bother the North Americans. And she asked me for a piece of bread. And so I took the bread basket, the whole bread basket, put it in a napkin, gave her the whole thing, and she left. Then I'm trying to talk to my uncle and my aunt, and she comes back. And then she asked me for butter. And so I took the whole bowl of butter from the napkin, you know, and gave it to her. And then she came back a third time. And this time she said, she looked up at me and she goes, and I'll be back tomorrow. Yeah. Well, at that point, I lost my appetite. I started to cry because, you know, I wouldn't be there tomorrow. I wouldn't be there tomorrow. So, you know, when we talk about liberation theology, we're talking about the root of it not being political, which are its consequences, and I'll talk about that a little later, but faith. It is faith in a vision or an experience of God within the people that are suffering, within the people that are struggling. It is a religious vision where God makes a preferential love for the poor and the marginalized. And it's a tension between what is and what should be. You know, I remember as a younger person that I used to say to my mother, you know, mommy, how come such and such is such and such? How come it's like this? And she'd say, mija, así es la vida. You know, my daughter, that's how life is. And I don't know why I reacted so violently to that and strongly, but I could not accept that. That was not acceptable to me. You know, and I would say to my mother, but it doesn't have to be that way. I cannot believe and I will not accept that it has to be that way. And I was 9 years old when I said that. So I don't know where that came from, but I probably from seeing all this poverty, but I just could not accept it. It's unacceptable to me that in the United States we have to have a certain percentage of people unemployed in order to make production work, you know? It is unacceptable to me that in a city as affluent and educated as Seattle, there's 5,000 homeless children. I mean, that's not acceptable to me. All right. So anyway, in the documents, and you know, my own tradition is Roman Catholic, it wasn't until, you know, 1968 in a place called Medellin, Colombia, where the bishops had a meeting where they even started to talk about the structural nature of violence. You know, not so much a concentration on our personal, individual sin, but rather what we do and don't do has a consequence that's much more communal and social. So in fact, they talk about something called social sin. Now, in the documents, they say, quote, that the Lord's mandate is to preach the gospel to the poor. And if that's true, if we believe that that's what the gospel is saying, then we must distribute our apostolic personnel, resources, and efforts so as to give preference to the poorest and the most neediest. And this also entails an active part on the part of Christians to denounce injustice and oppression. And Medellin hurts, or these kind of documents hurt, what liberation theology has to say hurts us, I think, especially in the first world, because it's going to demand radical changes and the abandoning of certain privileges that we have. And this can be very frightening. This is not easy stuff to listen to. I understand. You know, when I was working in the missions and my own work in justice work, let's just leave it at that, I remember going home every year to visit my father. And every year at the dinner table, my father would ask me this question. He'd say, "Mija, ¿qué religión eres tú?" Which means, "My daughter, what religion are you?" You know, I'd look at him and I'd go, "Dad, what are you talking about?" And I was a missionary. I go, "Dad, what are you talking about? I'm Catholic." "Of course I'm Catholic." He goes, "No, mija, tú no eres católica." "No, you're not Catholic." I go, "Dad, what am I?" He goes, "Mija, tú eres comunista." You know, "You're communist." That's what he would say to me. And now we'd have these big battles, you know? And every year he'd say at the dinner table, you know, I came to expect it, "Mija, ¿qué religión eres tú?" "Dad, I'm Catholic." "No, mija, tú no eres católica, tú eres comunista." I go, "Dad, I'm not a communist. Everything I do has a theological basis, you know?" And I was trying, I go, "Además," I go, "besides that, everything I do, you taught me." He goes, don't give me that. I won't tell you what he said. "Not my fault, no me eches la culpa, you know, don't blame me." So we get these really, you know, battles. And he was the one that was angry when I became a church member, because he said, "Todo para Dios y nada para la humanidad." Everything for God and nothing for the humanity. You know, as a Latin American, he had seen the corruption of the churches, and therefore he was not very thrilled that I was going to be, let alone a missionary, a theologian. So, you know, this really disturbed me. You know, it's really hard if you love, I love my father, you know, but he didn't understand what I was doing. He didn't approve what I was doing. He didn't value what I was doing. That's really hard, you know, when you attribute everything that you are to your dad. So this time what happened was I said, okay, I'm going home this year, and I want to be prepared for that question he's going to ask me. You know, I want to have a comeback, you know. And what I came back with was this video that I'm going to show you. And I go, oh, this is it. I'm going to show him this video, and I'll explain to him what it's all about. And Jim just left, and I wanted him to see this video, so I hope he's coming back. I'm gonna have to borrow it. So if you want to move your chairs and just look that way. And it's too light. Come on, lift up your leg up here. That'd be better. All right, so my dad asked me the question. You know, we're at the dinner table, and he says, "Mija, ¿qué religión eres tú?" And tú eres comunista. I go, "No, Dad, come here, I want to show you something, come here." So we go into the living room, and I go, "Sit down, Dad, and I want you to watch this, okay? I hope you understand what I do." Show the team.
exactly what happened. There was a silence. You know, and I said, "Dad?" And he had his head down. And I said, "Dad." "Dad, talk to me, Dad." And I go, "Dad, do you understand that there are lives in the balance?" "That I have no other choice but what I'm doing." And, you know, he looked up and he said, the only thing he said to me actually at the moment was, "But why you?" Right? Oh, no, another question I have to answer, you know. And, you know, so, I mean, we hugged and it was very emotional and stuff like that because he knew that I just had to do what I had to do, you know. And unless you see these faces, you know, like for many people, they look at this and, you know, it's a nice video. But for people who have been in the field, like I'm sure Jim and maybe others, these are faces and voices and experiences that sort of haunt you, you know? I don't know about Jim, but, you know, sort of like you carry these people and their lives in your mind and in your heart.
Is your father one of well-means and live well?
No, actually, that's the funny part. My father was a socialist. I mean, my father literally taught me everything I know. And I don't know what's happened to him in his old age. No, I think it's not a question of class. I think it's a question of danger. He, coming to this country, of course, you know, he wants me to be, you know, educated and well off. And so he doesn't understand why someone who's so educated would, in his words, work for the poor. You know, tanta educación para trabajar con los pobres, you know, porque. I mean, so he doesn't understand that. Also, there is a certain amount of danger in this kind of work, and so I think he's just concerned. I mean, no parent wants to see their child in danger. You know, no parent wants to see their child not live well, whatever that means. I mean, so, you know, my father sees that I live in a small house, and my kid sister has like a $300,000 house, you know, so that doesn't make sense to him. Why wouldn't I want those things? Yeah. So, yeah. Responses to what I've said so far, this video, before we move on. Any response, questions? What goes through your mind or your heart as you look at those images?
Well, I think it's hard to, because we live in the first world, and we are influenced by universities and influenced by intellectual thinking within our churches and within our schools. It's hard to have that kind of faith experience because we don't come from that.
Right.
And how,
but you know, the first world has a different kind of oppression. It's a different kind of, you know, the first time I came to Seattle was 4 years ago, and my first year I was teaching ministerial students preparing for ordination, and I really didn't like them. I really had a hard time my first year, and I was terrible to them, because they didn't get it. I didn't think they got it, you know? And it really wasn't until I started listening to them, really, to their story. And I found in their story an aloneness. An isolation that was so lonely that I wondered how they bear it, how they could bear it. You know, in other words, you know, I feel like when I fall, anybody knocks me down or something, I sort of fall on a whole civilization, you know, or a whole culture, or a whole, you know, communal basis, which is both not just cultural but religious for myself. Many of my students didn't have that; they were alone. Does that make sense? And therefore, the choices they make, you know, differ, you know, because they don't have that communal basis. It's really hard to live community when the only time you experience that is on Sunday, you know, at church, if you don't have it like in your family or your culture or whatever. Yes?
Well, it's funny you mentioned this because we've been in a Romans class and we touched on individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that that's a result of our individualism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Particularly in the United States.
That's right.
It's sort of become, you know, you do it your way, you do it on your own. And I think you have much more sense of community in your culture.
Well, you know, each culture has their their shadow side, so to speak. You know, each one has some, you know, are in need of conversion, you know, need of a change of heart. And you need to identify for yourselves, depending on what culture you are or what context you're in, where your own growth areas are. But yes, I think the challenge for us who live in North America is our consumerism, you know, our lack of wanting to know, you know, almost ignorance. I don't know, you know, and that not knowing is sort of a lack of responsibility. The individualism that you mentioned, you know, the isolation, you know. Do you think people would see less therapists if they had more soul friends? You know, we've become very psychologized in this culture, you know, and very shut down, I find. You know, I always ask my students to go out for a week and try to be emotionally honest with people, and they can't do it. And the reason they can't do it is because they come back and tell me people don't really want to know. So next time someone says to you, how are you? And you're really not that great, say it, see what happens. You know? Yeah, so what would happen if we could really say what was going on and that people would be responsive, you know?
Well, so when somebody says, you know, how are you, you think, oh, I bet they don't even care how I am.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how selfish people are. That's what I
think. So a good response might be, I don't think you really want to know.
Yeah. Well, getting back to liberation theology and spirituality, you know, one of the famous bishops from Brazil, Dom Helder Kamada, who is a real advocate for the poor, and he's really, really a very holy man. And it's really interesting because when he says things like, there are poor, people call him a saint. But when he says, why are there poor, they call him a communist. All right, so once you start getting into those structural, systemic questioning about why, you know, people start labeling you. It's the whole notion of, you know, the babies in the river. Did you ever hear the story? You know, there is a village, and a very kind village, and all of a sudden they see a baby in the river. And so they jump into the river, they save the baby. The next day there are two babies in the river, right? And the villagers, because they're good people, they jump into the river, save the two babies. You know, and 2 days later there are five babies and they lose one. You know, 2 days later there are eight babies. Well, you can continue to do that, what's called direct services or charity, and I'm not putting charity down in any way, I'm just saying respond to the crisis. Or what's the other alternative?
Find out why.
Go out the river and find out who's throwing the babies in the river. That's right. That's the difference between a systemic structural analysis, you know, finding out the root causes, and then doing something in terms of direct services. Does that make sense? And so one of the contributions that liberation theology and spirituality have made is to be concerned with the system, with the structure, you know, with the bigger picture. Dom Helder Kamara also says that the marginalized person is someone who is left by the wayside of the economic, socio-political, or cultural society. So if you wanted to develop your own theology of liberation here in the States, think of your own communities. Who are the people who are marginalized in your own communities? Who are the people that are on the wayside of the political, socioeconomic situation? Just name some of those people. Who are they?
Women.
Homosexuals.
Homeless.
Homeless.
Immigrants.
Immigrants. Which I think is really interesting, given that this country was built on the backs of immigrants, you know? But, yes. Who else in your communities? The rest of you don't have marginalized people in your communities?
Indigenous people.
Haitians? What?
Children are.
Indigenous people?
Children of single parents.
Children of single parents.
Handicapped.
Handicapped. That's right.
Children in the middle. Just average kids.
Okay, children in the middle, the lost child, as they call it in psychological terms. All right, so who are the poor and the oppressed? First of all, in Latin America, when we talk about the poor, we're talking about the poor collectively, because 80% of the population is poor, because 80% of the population is indigenous. Yeah. So, in other words, in Latin America, you have very few people who control the resources, like maybe five families. You know, in El Salvador, it's five families that control the whole resources of that country.
You know, I show you this particular video because the questions are questions for North Americans in terms of who are our friends? Who are we saying are our friends? You know, my students always get very upset when they find out that the El Salvadorian military leaders were trained in the United States, in Georgia, in the School of the Americas. That's very upsetting to them. Women, they're very idealistic, you know, as they should be. They should have to keep their ideals. And we do have these ideals on paper, right? But somewhere along the line, we kind of fall short in living them out, right? So the kinds of questions that the video asks, can anybody remember any of the phrases in the video that kind of stood out for them? Any images?
They sell us our clothes, our cars, our president, our religion.
You know, I used to laugh when people used to say that there was no propaganda in this country. You're kidding. Karen, what were you saying?
No, they stopped me talking about the shadow of the president's face.
That's right.
And then also the other thing that's striking the children. You know, it's one thing we think about people killing each other, we also think of men in uniform at war, but we don't realize that some of those wars, you know, whole families, entire villages, and that includes the women, the older people, and the children.
Yes. Anyone else? Okay, well, let me just give you a few highlights about liberation theology. So here are some key themes about liberation theology. First of all, it focuses on living faith and the practice of liberation. In other words, words are not enough. You have to do something. You know, I tell my students at the university, I don't care what you do, but do something. Whatever. And I really felt bad this last quarter because this student wrote me a note. Actually, it was her reflection paper. And at the end of the reflection paper, she wrote me a little note. She says, you know, Dr. Rodriguez, I don't have time to volunteer for this or that, and I can't do this and that, and I can't do all the things you invite us to, but I want to show my solidarity with, you know, the poor in Seattle, the homeless. So she gave up her bed. She gave her bed away. You know, and at first I was like, oh my God. I didn't know whether to react positively or negatively. Was I having a good or a bad influence on my students, you know? And then I sort of just resigned myself to the fact that she could afford to be altruistic. You know, she was a not young 20-year-old college student. If she wanted to sleep on the floor, she could. But that kind of motivation, you know, to do something. That the living God that we believe in is a God that sides with those that are oppressed and not with the pharaohs of the world, whoever they may be. That the kingdom, the reign of God, is God's project in history. That's what it's all about. How to bring about the reign of God. And you know, you need to be really careful because, again, there are political implications to this kind of theology and spirituality. I want to admit that. But it's only because we are embodied and we live within a historical, economic, political context. I mean, we can do nothing else but live through our bodies and through our history. And so if we want to bring about the reign of God, we're going to have to get sort of our hands dirty and get involved, you know, in the world. Jesus, the Son of God, took on oppression in order to set us free. The Holy Spirit is present in the struggles of the oppressed. For Latin America, especially with their devotion of Mary. Mary is a prophetic and liberating woman of her people. Her scriptures, her fiat, her magnificat. For many in Latin America, what's called comunidades de bases, small base communities, these are the signs and instruments of liberation. These are small home churches. The rights of the poor are God's rights. And liberated human potential becomes liberative. What that means is that in order to transform the world, you have to be transformed. Okay, you can't get what you don't got, basically. All right, as we say in New York. So something has to happen to you. You know, some kind of conversion has to happen for you. Some kind of change in heart has to happen for you in order for you to go out and try to do that to anyone else or with anyone else. Does that make sense? you know, that song, Let Peace Begin With Me, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, the way that's been read, especially in North America, is a lot of people feel that, I've not done that yet, therefore I can't do anything, you know. And they don't realize that sometimes in the going out, you come home. Does that make sense? You know, you could take either position. I can't do anything until I get this taken care of. Well, you could be there for ages, right? Or in the going out, in the giving of self, you find self. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? As I mentioned before, liberation theology is a theology of the people. It doesn't come from the intelligentsia or the universities or the affluent, but it comes from below. And so what does that mean? Characteristics from below. If you were to do theology in a very different way, which is what liberation theology is about, you do it from below, which means it's a different starting point. Starting point is not the university, it's not the theologians, it's not the affluent, it's not the powerful, but it's the poor. In other words, the you know, how many of you have children? Okay, so if you're standing up, you know, as an adult, and then you go down to your knees and take the position of your child and look up, doesn't things look different? Right? Same idea, theologically or politically, all right? That you're in a different perspective. Right, you're looking at things. Things look a little bit different, right? And in this theology, it's different. Don't be frightened by that big word. I don't know why academicians just don't use ordinary English, but that word means who's your dialogue partner. And in Latin America, the dialogue partner is what's called as the non-person. I don't know if you were able to really see those images on the video, but there really is a lack of respect for human life in a lot of those countries. I mean, you know, when I was there during the coup, I mean, they would shoot at kids for target practice, right? When I would go down there, the military would constantly take my passport and ask me to pick it up later that evening. You know, so they had different intentions. Ecuador, Peru, Colombia. So, you know, our Christian tradition has these wonderful documents about the sacrality of human life, you know, the dignity of the human person. You know, I don't know in your own tradition, but I know in the Roman Catholic tradition, they have the whole tradition is based on this notion of the dignity of the human person and the sacrality of life. You know, we talk a lot about rights in this country, like we just assume we all have rights, right? But in many parts of the world, people are non-persons. They have no rights, they're objects or subjects, you know, or slaves. A different set of tools, and let me explain what that means. In classical theology, the discipline that we sort of rely a lot on is philosophy, right? But in liberation theology, we utilize the social sciences. Okay, we look at the social situation, the political, the economic, and that's where we get in trouble. That's where we get called Marxists. Because we use Marxian analysis, economic analysis, it's like using Freud, the id, ego, superego, and being called Freudian. All right? That's not to say there aren't Marxists who are liberation theologians, but I'm saying not all of us are, you know, even though we utilize the tools. Does that make sense? That we utilize the social sciences. And it's a different analysis because what you're dealing with, especially in those kind of situations, is conflict. You know, Christians don't do very well with conflict. Not interpersonal conflict, not social conflict. You know, we really kind of avoid that. Yet these situations are full of conflict, right? Full of crisis. It's a different kind of engagement, praxis, okay, which is the immersion of the experience, okay? And then theology becomes the second act. Now let me try to make that clear. In other words, you really can't do theology until you act. That's a very different MO than classical theology, which has been kind of coming out of the rational left brain, you know, tradition, sort of like, you know, it's up here in the head.
Right.
And so this is saying, no, you can't even do theology, you can't even talk about God, you know, unless you're involved in justice, unless you're involved in loving relationships. Then you do the reflection about what you're doing. Does that make sense? That you have to act first before you can sit back and reflect on something. See, a lot of people just want to reflect and think with no action, right? Praxis means you get involved in action and you step back and do reflection, theological, which leads you then to the next action, right? Does that make sense? And so that's the kind of methodology, if you will, that's used. Or another one, very simple, is ver, juzgar y actuar. To see, to judge, to act. To open your eyes, this is the hard part. Open your eyes to see what is reality. You know, this is a call to leave la-la land, all right? Really, I talk to people, they really do live in la-la land. I know it's hard, I mean, I don't like reality as much as anybody else sometimes, but you have to see reality for what it is, to see. Then you judge. What is the criteria for us as Christians to judge but scriptures, or for some of us, scripture and tradition, all right? So we must have a criteria by which to judge what we see, right? And then that must lead us to action. So if people are being marginalized, okay, so let's say in Seattle, we have 5,000 homeless children. That's the reality, that's the data, that's the facts. I see 5,000 children that are homeless in Seattle. Now I judge. By what criteria? What would Jesus say? How would Jesus respond? What is God's intent? God's intent is not for children to be on the streets in the cold weather of Seattle with no jackets on, all right? And then I have to respond to that judgment, you know? And then there are a variety of ways of responding. Some people respond from a charitable position, and then some people respond in a more systemic position, which involves political, structural analysis, that kind of stuff. Okay? So does that make sense? Is that helpful to just understand where this theology is coming from? Okay. Any questions? Any response? How does this sound to you? What goes on in your head as you hear this? Please don't call me a communist. I couldn't take it anymore. Yes.
The thing that I can move on is we're talking about the left brain. I'm a right brain person. And the whole area is shut down oftentimes with even religion. There's no kinesthetic experience getting into it first. That's just the right brain,
right.
Without the emotions, without the color, without it's closed. And how do you open, do the kinesthetic first?
Right. Well, and you know, one of the things that I do, for example, at my own university is I have my students do something called service learning. So anyone who takes my class, now they get 5 credits for it, but instead of 3. But anyone who takes my class has to do 15 hours of community service. And I pick the agencies. And it's amazing the change that happens. At first they hate it. They hate me. They resist the process. You know, and some of them drop out of my class. But the ones who stay go through a radical transformation before the quarter is out. Because, and I say to them, you know, everyone's going to want you because you're slave labor. So I don't want you doing paperwork. I don't want you to do gardening. I don't want you to do any manual labor. What I want you to do is be involved interpersonally with the people. I want you to find out the names of the homeless person you're working with. You know, I want you to establish relationships with those children in first place, which is a school for homeless children. So it's a school, we have a school in Seattle where kids can go who are homeless. You know, I want you to learn their names and get to know them, okay? Because then they don't become, oh, that homeless kid over there that I did. They become Rachel, you know, or Matthew, you know. And I've come to learn that people don't change because of ideas. People change because of other people, right? Or I take my students to, and faculty, to what's called cultural immersion experience, where you have to go and experience, you're right, other. It's really hard to be sensitized to something you don't see, you know. And yet, you know, there is a need for people to make commitments, like even if you're not in the trenches, to support the people who are in the trenches. So there are a variety of responses. You know, but the hard part, and I think this is where the spirituality comes in, is to learn to listen. You know, that's the hard part. To be open enough to listen so that you can then be open to what kind of response you're going to give. You know, the listening, the taking in is really the hardest part. Because who wants to be uncomfortable? Right? I mean, right? Who wants to feel guilty? No one wants to feel those things. And when I show people these things, my intent is not to make them feel guilty, but just to show them that this is how 2/3 of the world lives. Right? Maybe not us, but many, many people live like this. And I don't believe it's God's intent for the world to live this way.
Are we afraid to respond?
Well, you have to tell me. Are you afraid to respond, or do you know people who are afraid to respond?
Well, I'm afraid and not knowing, you know, what to do, how far to go.
Sure.
You know.
Those are all good questions and concerns, but you know what? You don't have to do it alone. See, that's another thing that kind of truncates us here. We always feel like we got to do it alone. I can do it. I, myself, and I. You know, instead, you know, even Jesus didn't send people out alone, right? He sent them out 2 by 2. There was a reason for that. You know, there is strength in numbers, not just politically, but psychologically and spiritually, in terms of community. Okay. Anyone else want to respond? Yes.
So why didn't some of your students like the idea?
Well, in the beginning, by the time I get through with them, they're very different.
Sure.
Yeah. I love undergrads for that reason. Graduate students, I have to hit them over the head a little bit, but my undergrads, I absolutely adore. Because they're open. They're willing to, you know, struggle with it and make sense out of it, and they're still idealistic at that age. I remember I had a little ROTC young woman in my class. You know ROTC, you know where they... And I was talking about the military, and I have some very strong feelings about the military. And she raised her hand and she goes, Dr. Rodriguez, you know, I just got back from sleeping with an M16. I went, oh, you know, I didn't know she was an ROTC at the time. And I said, well, yeah, you want to say something about that? And she was like, well, I just wanted an education. All she wanted was, all she saw ROTC for was an opportunity to be educated, which, you know, sort of makes sense. And she never really questioned what the implications were or what some of the possible consequences were, you know. I had another guy in my class who was also ROTC. And when I was doing something on El Salvador, I asked him, you know, they were the students who were in ROTC were really struggling with what I was telling them and the fact that they were going to be in the military and they would have to follow orders. You know, so what are the ethical, you know, dimensions to that? So I would say, okay, John, you know, so if your commander wanted to send you to El Salvador to support the military, given what you know now, given everything I've told you, would you go? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, that's good, you know, I don't know, it means you're thinking, I like that, you know, and I said, well, let me ask you something, do you believe what I tell you, do you believe what I'm telling you? He goes, yes, Dr. Rodriguez, I believe you, and do you believe what I'm showing you? Yes, I believe you. And I said, and if your commander asked you to go, would you go? And he still didn't know, so we left it at that. The woman, on the other hand, had to apply for a CO status. You know, it's really, really interesting how different people respond, you know. But I think, you know, one of the things that we need to do with our children or our students or whoever is our constituency is really to help them understand the ethical implications of the kind of choices they make and don't make. Because I think that we get hookwinked in just believing that we're responsible for what we do. Well, I didn't do anything. I didn't do that. Not my fault. And they leave it at that. Instead of, well, yeah, you didn't do anything, and you also, I mean, could have done something. I mean, it's not just what you do, it's what you don't do. It has a consequence, right? And to get people to start thinking about that is difficult because they're not used to thinking like that at that level. Right? So it's another way of thinking, another perspective, as I was saying. Now, when I talk about liberation theology emerges out of the context of Latin America. But liberation theology, or the theologies of liberation, have emerged now, and now we're in the States. And different theologies of liberation have emerged. So, for example, feminist theology, which comes out of the woman's experience, emerges. Chicano theology, a theology that emerges out of US-born individuals of Mexican-American descent. You know, black theology, liberation theology, comes out of the context, the experience of black experience. So we have a number of different theologies of liberation. All of them have in common the belief in a God who wants us to be free, you know? A God who calls us to wholeness. A God who asks us to confront and to struggle against any form of oppression, in whatever form it comes in. The form that I'm highlighting for you now is political and economic and social, but there are other forms of oppression that are intrapsychic, interpersonal, you know, communal, familial, ecclesial. There are many, many forms of oppression. And what I'm inviting you to do is to be able to go out with new eyes so that you can identify those oppressive situations and know that you are called to freedom. Know that you are called to be free. God calls you to be free. God calls you to be whole. So you don't have to live under those situations of oppression. And where there is one, there are others. Because that which is most private is really universal. The thing that you think only happened to you and is only yours, believe me, a whole bunch of other people feel that way. Anything else anybody want to say or ask?
Well, I've just heard people argue against liberation theology, and I'm just curious for you to talk a little bit about that. And what are the critics of it say? In particular, I run across that in more sort of conservative religious groups.
Well, I mean, there are a number of critiques, you know, so it'd be more helpful if you had one in mind. But one of them, of course, is that the Marxist connection. But that's more because Marxist was against religion, not because of the analysis Marx offered about economics, you know? So, you know, when you listen to a critique, you really have to figure out where it's really coming from. The other problem is that there are some places in Latin America, for example, where people have taken up arms. Because the violence is so institutionalized, the violence is so great that they feel that the only response is violence. Now, that's a real hard thing to talk about because unless you've been in a situation like that, or at least I should say, having been in a situation like that, it's very easy to talk pacifism when I'm here. Nobody's pointing a gun to me. Nobody's going to hurt me here. It's a different place. It's much easier. So, you know, while I would never condone violence, there's a part of me that understands it, if that makes sense. Yeah. And even saying that makes me a little nervous. But it's really hard to judge unless you've been in those situations. Anyone else? Yes.
I think of this in terms of our church, which is an inner city church. And we have Central Americans, we have blacks now coming in, some few Indian population. But I think when we look at ministering them to them, we're thinking of making them Swedish, Muslim. And that's another kind of oppression.
That's right.
We should be changing some of what we're doing. Sure, we sing the Spanish songs once in a while, but I'm suddenly very concerned about what our expectations are and how we are being service to them.
See, those are the hard questions you have to wrestle with your community. I know the Hispanic Catholics have accused the Roman Catholic Church of being more interested in Americanizing us than in Christianizing us, you know, or bringing us before the presence of God. So those are critiques that are coming up and then have to be addressed. You have to figure out how you know, people are called to union with God. And how does a particular community or institution or church provide the kind of opportunities that are inclusive enough to not violate anybody, either their culture or their person or their gender. I mean, I was so happy to come here. This is my first time, and see how serious you take inclusive language, because for many women, it's very painful. Language is very painful.
You know, I hold the Catholic Church responsible for setting the stage for social injustice, for oppression, for exploitation, for all of these things, that, these social ills that you're talking about in Latin America. Not all of them, of course, began with the coming of Christianity to the New World, but the Church played a part in setting that stage, mm-hmm. and in cooperating with the government, and in taking lands from Indian people, and by stealing their soul, like we were talking about yesterday, mm-hmm. and not respecting the indigenous spirituality. Mm-hmm. And now, I think the Church has, I hold them accountable for this, and I think that it's gonna, the Church has to play the leading role in righting these wrongs, you know, that were committed and continue to be committed. Carmen, about 15 years ago, worked for Progressive Grants of the Catholic Church in the Amazon in Brazil, mm-hmm. to document the injustices committed not only by the government but by the Church itself. Mm-hmm. And we could see firsthand where the Church was taking people off, the natives off their reservation, assimilating them, sending them to live in poverty and destitution in the cities, and then the Church has confiscated all these vast territories. This continues to happen in Brazil and different parts of Latin America. Mm-hmm. I know the Church is, you have two schools of thought, two different factions of the Church. But
well, I mean, first of all, I want to say yes, that's true, that the history of the institutional Church, and I make a distinction between the institutional Church and the Church, people of God. We, who are Church, you know, must take responsibility, because otherwise you get into blaming. So where have I worked or not worked? I, who am Church, we, who are Church. So yes, historically, institutional Church has been corrupt. I've learned in my own experience, and after my own theological training, that whatever is made up by humans doesn't scandalize me anymore in terms of, you know, the human condition, which is sinful and need of conversion. But for every story and experience you can tell me of the institutional Church that has violated or persecuted or hurt a person or a people, there are the Oscar Romeros out there, there are the Adas out there, you know, there are the Carmens out there, you know, who have sacrificed their life because of their Christian belief, have sacrificed their life and have even been martyred, you know, to stand with the poor. And it's been a conversion experience. I mean, when Oscar Romero, the Roman Catholic Bishop of El Salvador, was chosen, he was chosen at first because he was a mouse. You know, he was a bookworm. The hierarchy thought that he wouldn't cause any waste. But you know what? What they didn't count on was that Monsignor Romero was a prayerful man. Okay? He was a prayerful man. And when he prayed, okay, he heard the cry of the poor. And when he was able to hear, you know, and respond from his God-centered position, then he had to do something about it. If you look at his talks, he used to say, now the Church has to take a medium position, right? The Church is a great reconciler. The Church has really tried to do that. But in that situation, he couldn't. And so he moved over here with the poor. And he said, stop the oppression. Stop murdering. You have to stop sending, you know, and they killed him. You know, and they killed him.
Oh, then again, you have the incident where when the Pope went to Nicaragua, mm-hmm. and he was met by Ernesto Cardenal.
That's right, and he went like this
to him. Got on his knees to kiss him. The Pope castigated him.
That's right.
For what he was doing in Nicaragua.
That's right.
That was horrible. Terrible. That was a sin.
Terrible, absolutely terrible.
When the Pope came to Phoenix, he harshly criticized liberation theology, mm-hmm. and it was in all the papers in Phoenix. And we live in Arizona, where it's an ultra-conservative state. We certainly didn't need the Pope
to do that
and justify the position of the ultra-conservative.
Well, this is an example of some of the critique of liberation theology. There is a branch of the Church that's very conservative, you know.
What are they threatened by?
That's a really good question. What do you think they're threatened by?
Loss of
They're part of the power structure.
That's right.
See, most, that's the other thing that's so important that we also didn't talk, you know, here, is in America we do have the separation of the state and the church. In our constitution here, it's separated. In Latin America, there's not like that. The church and the state are together.
And so
we have the governor's house in my hometown in Brazil. I have the governor's palace, and right across the street, the bishop's palace.